Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in the news, Shirley Sherrod, financial reform and a storm brews in the Gulf. USDA official Shirley Sherrod portrayed as racist, then race hero. Secretary Tom Vilsack said he moved too quickly to fire her.
I didn't take the time. I should have. And as a result, a good woman has gone through a very difficult period.
Wall Street reform is on the president's desk and signed into law.
These reforms represent the strongest consumer financial protections in history.
And Tropical Storm Bonnie brewing in the Gulf, ships fleeing, cleanup operation halted. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are we getting Wall Street right? What's the lesson in the Shirley Sherrod story? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Chrystia Freeland, global editor-at-large for Reuters. Chrystia, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
And from Washington, Dana Milbank is here, columnist for The Washington Post, writes the Washington Sketch column. His latest book is Homo Politicus, The Strange and Scary Tribes That Run Our Government. Dana, welcome back as well.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and Dana.
Let's go straight to this Shirley Sherrod story. I suppose everybody's heard it, but now let's listen once more, though. First, to the excerpt that got everybody's attention. This is after the NAACP complained about racist elements in the Tea Party. And then from the right, biggovernment.com, Breitbart et al., kicking back with this carefully excerpted bit of a 20-year-old speech or so, 1986. She was talking, at an NAACP banquet in March, about an incident back in the 80s when she was not with the government but with a private aid group, and a white farmer came to this black American for help.
I was struggling with the fact that so many black people have lost their farmland, and here I was faced with having to help a white person save their land. So I didn't give him the full force of what I could do.
Anti-white racism was the charge, and before she knew it, she was out of a job. But that was hardly the whole story. If you went on to listen to the full tape, she was actually drawing a pretty great message of tolerance and looking across color lines. Here's what she eventually said in the same speech she learned from this longer interaction.
But working with him made me see that it's really about those who have versus those who don't. You know, and they could be black, they could be white, they could be Hispanic. And it made me realize then that I needed to work to help poor people, those who don't have access the way others have.
Now the USDA is offering her a job again. Dana Milbank, what do you make of the whole meteoric kind of rise in the headlines of this story, its genesis, and what we take from all the reaction to it?
Well, you know, it's just the latest sign of the new media environment we live in. It's not even a daily cycle or an hourly news cycle. It is minute by minute. And I think this is a good example of what happens here because of the internet, because of cable news, that it's more important for people to get out the story than to figure out exactly what the facts are first. And this sort of thing has happened before, and it will happen over and over again. I think the difference here is the White House and certainly the Agriculture Department got ahead of themselves and got swept up in the whole sort of instant reaction that the blogosphere demands, and that was a big mistake.
It's fast. It's minute by minute. Maybe it's too fast. But, Jack, even in that fast period, we see something in people's instant reactions to a story. What do you make of the administration's reaction to the sudden appearance of this little bit of tape in the sort of right-wing news world?
Well, it's further evidence a year after the Skip Gates incident in Cambridge, just a year after it, that the White House is neuralgic on racial issues. This has just happened again and again. They don't want to be painted as somehow favoring African Americans, favoring minorities because we have a black president. And that is the narrative that is pushed ahead by this leaked tape. And this doctored tape. And there's another element we're going to hear more about here that perhaps is even more important. People are speculating, and I think with good grounds, that Mr. Breitbart held on to this, had this tape for some time, and held on to it not just to time it to the Tea Party back and forth, but rather to get ahead of an issue of simple justice. The Agriculture Department discriminated against African Americans for generations. In the 90s, a settlement was reached awarding them now about $1 billion. That has yet to be paid. When he was a senator, Senator Obama pushed strongly for this. That payment, those payments now are on the line. That bill is connected to the bigger bill funding Afghanistan. And it's a question whether that's going to be able to go through. Republicans are against it. Conservative talk show people are saying this is favoritism to African Americans. And this whole issue just now, highlights this trope that's being used. It's nothing of the kind of fairness. This is a matter of simple justice.
Chrystia Freeland, do you see this administration as somehow allergic about getting near racial issues? President Obama spoke out very famously during the campaign. His Philadelphia speech, everybody will recall, he went straight at it. But have the politics of now made this administration nervous about touching this?
Absolutely. And I don't think that's a contradiction to the Philadelphia speech. You know, I think that what this administration is very, very scared of, and rightly so, is that because President Obama is black, it will trigger, it will make possible, particularly for politicians on the right, to fight racial politics again in the United States and to make the narrative about, you know, interestingly, I was really glad that you played all of Shirley Sherrod's speech, because I think she made a great point that you can look at America in two ways. You can have a racial narrative or you can have an economic narrative. I think this administration is fighting very hard to make it an economic narrative. A great way to undermine that is to make it a story about race. And I think that debate is going to become a bigger and bigger one, maybe not explicitly, but implicitly, because unemployment is very high. Even as jobs start to come back, those jobs are going to be low-paying jobs. We are living through this hollowing out of the American middle class at a time when we see Wall Street rebounding with incredible strength and corporate America in general being mm-hmm. very strong.
Seen that this
so
week.
You can mm-hmm. see for the Democratic Party a sort of haves versus have-nots being a very powerful narrative. A great way to undermine that from the right is to say, well, actually, this isn't a story about the two Americas on economic issues. It's a story about the different colors of America.
Shirley Sherrod saying this week, and we heard her right there, that it's really about economics. They could be black, they could be white, they could be Hispanic. It's an economic issue. But she couldn't get that message heard in the midst of the storm that blew up here. Here she is on NBC's Today Show.
That is so hard to take, especially when I kept saying, look at the entire thing, look at my message, and no one would listen. No one would listen.
Nobody would listen. Soon she was out of a job. Now she's been offered a job again. Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, trying to draw a bigger lesson as he said something wrong had happened here.
One of the great lessons you take away from this is to ask all the questions first and to come to that fuller understanding. I say that, again, from the perspective of this administration. I say that from the perspective of those that cover this administration and those that are involved in the back and forth in the political theater of this country.
Ask all the questions first, but we saw which way the knee jerked when it jerked Wilbert in Allendale, South Carolina. Wilbert, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you see?
I see racism still alive, well, and kicking strong. That lady's father was murdered in South Georgia during the Civil Rights Movement, and the whole case against the white farmer that murdered her father was dismissed. But there's no statute of limitation on murder. Black farmers was cursed out and spit on at USDA offices in the South in the 80s, in the 90s, and denied loans, and not a one of them has been fired. I blame this administration for firing that lady and not investigating the whole story.
Were you surprised to see the Obama administration firing?
Yes, I do. For not investigating the whole story before they fired that lady. Because they didn't fire one USDA agent who discriminated against black farmers. Not one. They retired with joy.
Back in the day. Wilbert, thanks for your call. And one more, Carl in Nashville. Carl, you're on.
Hey, guys, I tell you what, the best thing that's going to come out of this is that the line that has been drawn is not about black and white so much. It's about the have and the have-nots. The second best thing is going to come out of this, and I don't know about you guys, but I smell the familiar stench of the Southern strategy brung on by Fox News. And I think that Fox News have been exposed as what they are, a news organization arm of the Republican and conservative movement. They're not news. They make up things. And I'm finally glad to see other news organizations such as CNN and the other networks finally calling them out for their reckless behavior over there ever since this president has been. As a matter of fact, before he was even elected, you could smell the stench, the garbage smell of the old Southern strategy that they're applying over there at Fox News.
Carl, we got the view. We're going to look more at that on Monday. We're going to look more at this issue right here, right now, today. I appreciate your call as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Financial reform signed. Shirley Sherrod and a media race blow-up. A big climate change bill off the table. Bonnie, what, bearing down on the Gulf of Mexico and the blown-out wellhead there. Krista Freeland is with us from Reuters. Dana Milbank is here from the Washington Post, our own Jack Beatty. Dana Milbank, you're there in Washington. If indeed part of what we're going to see in the in a political standoff is here is an economic argument versus a race argument, which do you see as the stronger hand, Dana?
Well, I mean, just given the passions in this country, you know, an economic argument is a rational one that appeals to the intellect, whereas the racial arguments are all about a passion and instinct, and that's going to win every time here. You know, what happened, I think there was sort of a premature euphoria when President Obama was elected that, you know, the nation had conquered its racial demons. I don't think President Obama thought that, and in fact, he said he didn't believe that. And I think we're now seeing that along with that triumph, it stirred up a lot of other issues on the right and also some uncomfortable things on the left. And that's going to – there's no way to get rid of that now. That's just out in the open, and it's going to keep playing over and over.
Is the White House kind of nervous Nelly on race? Are they not willing to sort of – I mean, why didn't they stand the ground for 24 hours and figure out what the story was about on Sherrod?
I think the White House is a nervous Nelly full stop, and they're often responding too quickly. During the campaign, they were very good at not yielding to the minute-by-minute news cycle. They seem to have lost that now, and they seem to be panicked. A lot of that has to do with the president's lower standing, but they seem unable to keep focused on their own agenda and being forceful about their agenda and are instead giving in to others.
Of course, a very big piece of that agenda actually pushed through this week, President Obama signing that sweeping financial reform bill into law after, what, more than a year of political battle and compromise. Here he is.
Passing this bill was no easy task. To get there, we had to overcome the furious lobbying of an array of powerful interest groups and a partisan minority determined to block change.
And nearly did. Just two Republicans on board. And after passage, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, no bouquets for this legislation from the GOP corner. He says the point is this and other bills are not helping the unemployment situation.
Millions of Americans are struggling to find jobs, and yet all they see in Washington are Democrats passing massive bills that at their core seem to have one thing in common: more job loss.
Krista Freeland, this financial reform package, do you see more job loss in this package?
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, I think that reality of financial regulation is, you know, to use maybe a homey metaphor, you can think about it like the way we regulate our cars and our highways. And if we wanted to get places really, really fast, as quickly as possible, we could have highways with no speed limits. Most of us would get places really, really quickly. We would have car crashes, though, and we would have really big car crashes.
So that means it's kind of more job loss. More job loss compared to what, if you look at it that way? Because we lost an awful lot of jobs in the big crash.
Absolutely. It's it's whether you're looking forward or looking back. What this financial legislation does and what financial, you know, the purpose of it was to slow down the speed of financial capital. Financial capital was moving too fast. Prior to the crisis, people thought that was fantastic. Mm-hmm. You had people singing the praises of Wall Street.
Let's go. Let's boogie.
Be less regulated. Exactly. And there was, in fact, a competition between New York and London over who could deregulate the fastest to attract the most risk excited about risk firms. And, you know, America and the world is now paying the price. It does mean, though, you know, capital is going to move a little more slowly. Having said that, and I'm going to sound like a very patriotic Canadian, which I am, north of the border, where financial regulation was tougher, where financial capital was moving more slowly, you actually didn't have a financial crisis. The banks did not have to be bailed out. The Canadian economy is growing really, really strongly right now. So in the short term, yes, it's true. This is legislation that Wall Street hates because Wall Street knows it means you can't, you know, drive without a speed limit. In the medium term, is it better for society and for the economy to have speed limits, seat belts, and airbags? Yes, absolutely.
Dana Milbank, if Wall Street indeed hates it, and of course there's a lot to be hammered out in the fine detail of the regulation, but if they hate it, that would suggest that it's the real deal, that it's going to be effective. Do you see it that way? Is that what you're hearing, Dana?
Well, I mean, they hate it, I suppose, in the sense that they hate any regulation, but certainly not. It's been watered down substantially from what people were talking about in the first place. So business interests throughout the negotiation got a lot of what they were looking for in terms of the protections for industry. So I think people, if they're giving a candid assessment of this, is yes, it will be a sort of a modest increase in regulations, and from the point of view of people trying to keep the markets in check, a modest improvement, but nothing that's going to I mean, the idea of suggesting that this would be some sort of a devastating job loss when, in fact, the absence, as Christy was saying, the absence of regulation led directly to this crisis that destroyed millions of jobs. It's sort of preposterous to compare that to and now suggest that there'll be job loss as a result of regulation.
Wall Street itself in the headlines for some pretty big hiring in the last in recent weeks, not to mention big bonuses that they shoveled out as they were getting bailed out. The numbers now come out. President Obama is saying that this will help get us away from the debt-based bubble.
And these protections will be enforced by a new consumer watchdog with just one job, looking out for people, not big banks, not lenders, not investment houses, looking out for people as they interact with the financial system. And that's not just good for consumers, that's good for the economy. Because reform will put a stop to a lot of the bad loans that fueled a debt-based bubble.
Jack Beatty, do you feel the needle really moved this week? It was a long struggle to get this passed. It was a close thing. It was watered down in part, as Dana said, but it's passed. Do you think we've got, is there a new climate?
Well, I think, you know, there's something in that room. Even as he was speaking, there was a person in the front row, and I think a lot depends on her. You don't want to personalize these big things too much, but I think a lot does depend on the person named to head the Consumer Watchdog Bureau in the Fed. And the idea for it came from our friend Elizabeth Warren at Harvard Law School. She was there, and there's much debate now whether she will be named. And the analogy people are using is that FDR in the 30s put a very tough guy, Joseph P. Kennedy, in charge of the SEC, and he made Wall Street toe the line because, of course, he had been a big Wall Street manipulator himself. That's not true of Elizabeth Warren. She's a fighter for the middle class. And I think there's a shaping up a big debate over whether the Senate will confirm her. Now, Senator Dodd this week said there were doubts about her confirmability. Even people in his caucus were a little uneasy. Wall Street is absolutely panicked about it because she means business. So a long story short, I think a lot depends really on getting that agency right. And my money would be on Elizabeth Warren.
Dana Milbank, what do you hear in Washington about her confirmability?
Well, there's a lot of hesitation. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner denies it, but is said to have not be a huge fan of this possibility. It's impossible to predict these things in advance. But that's another instance of the legislation not necessarily being all that is chalked up to be, depending on how it's implemented.
Let's get a call from Savannah. Christian.
I was just going to jump in quickly and say I think that Jack is absolutely right to point to Elizabeth Warren, because one of the interesting things about this legislation is a lot of it depends on how it is implemented. A lot of it depends on the discretion of the regulators. It didn't have to be that way, but the way a lot of those fudges and compromises that Dana was talking about earlier were resolved is, rather than taking a tough, firm stance in writing, things were punted over to the regulator. So really, in this particular case, who the people are in those posts matters more than it often does.
And who has the kind of authority and bullhorn to complain if it doesn't go the consumer way? Let's go to Savannah, Georgia. Jamie, you're on the air.
How are you?
Well.
Well, this is back to the unemployment issue you were discussing a few minutes ago.
Yes.
We are a medium-sized business in Savannah. I'm the owner. We roughly employ 45, 47 employees.
Okay. How's business, Jamie? How's business?
Business is actually very good. We are up about 92% over last year.
Great. That's good. So what's on your mind?
Well, we've got people that we hire at all levels. And what we're seeing now over the past 6 weeks is people who are applying for jobs and could get hired, but they would rather be paid under the table to not interrupt their unemployment checks.
Are you willing to do that?
No, we are not willing to do that.
Are other employers that you know of?
I know a couple of friends who are in different industries who have actually started reporting these individuals to the Department of Labor.
What do you think ought to happen here, Jamie?
I really don't know. You try to hire people, but I think they've just become so accustomed to being paid for non-labor or non-work that they are out of the workforce, as long as the money continues to come in for no work being done.
Of course, they're ready to come and work, but they don't want to lose that the backup of unemployment there. Jamie, thanks for your call. Jack, what do you make of that story? There's a frontline economic report on, you know, an employer's view, and nervous employers, or he might say, you know, greedy potential off-the-books employees.
Very interesting, and I have no doubt that Jamie is documenting a widespread phenomenon. This is, we're talking here about human nature, and people game systems, and I have no doubt that people are gaming this system all over. However, his conclusion that somehow this gets back to the corrupting effects of unemployment compensation, I think that really needs to be called into question. What he's seeing is an abuse of a system, but the system itself is not only helping people pay their bills and stay in their homes, it's an elixir for the economy. It's a stimulant to get all of get prosperity going again. I think he's indicting human nature, not unemployment compensation.
Republicans this week, after the unemployment benefits were extended for the long-term unemployed, were talking about a kind of what they described as an abuse of the system. Also, extending those employments without cutting elsewhere. Here's Arizona Republican John Kyle.
While President Obama argues that we've increased the debt in the past to pay for other things, I'll note that we weren't in the middle of a debt crisis back then, for one thing. I suggest we pass a bill that's paid for now.
It wasn't, but Republicans weren't on board. Dana Milbeck, what about the politics of this unemployment? How do you see this one playing out? Republicans pretty, pretty solid against extending those benefits. We see maybe some abuse of the system from our Savannah caller. We also see a lot of people in pretty dire need of some kind of support when there just aren't enough jobs to go around.
Right. I think the point the caller made there is at the very heart of the debate that's been going on these last couple of months. And that is, I think that the debt question is really a sideshow that the Republicans have been using so as not to take the issue on directly. But the question is it discouraging people from working and employers from hiring and coming into the workforce? You've even had, in some extreme cases, the woman opposing Senator Harry Reid in Nevada saying that only, I think the word was only the lazy folks are taking the unemployment insurance. So you had President Obama come out, I think it was Monday morning, in the Rose Garden with people who had actually been pounding the pavement trying to get work and say these people aren't looking for a handout. They want to work, but they need their unemployment extension. Now, he knew that the Senate was on the verge of approving it anyway, so he could then get credit for it. But they finally wore down the resistance and got that renewed.
They got it renewed, and a lot of people still looking for jobs and not enough jobs to go around. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke talking this week, testifying before Congress on the state of the economy, talking about the unusual uncertainty of the U.S. economy right now. Raise some eyebrows. Let's listen.
Even as the Federal Reserve continues prudent planning for the ultimate withdrawal of extraordinary monetary policy accommodation, we also recognize that the economic outlook remains unusually uncertain. We will continue to carefully assess ongoing financial and economic developments, and we remain prepared to take further policy actions as needed.
Chrystia Freeland, give us some interpretation here. That can sound like a pretty wide-open depiction of risk, unusually uncertain from a Fed chief. What's the sense in New York of where this economy is now? Is it teetering? Is it gradually headed somewhere positive or the opposite?
Well, I would say that Ben Bernanke is right on the money. I think that what he said now, there may be questions around whether it's good for Fed chairman to be quite so frank. But that point about unusual uncertainty is something that I hear from CEOs and from their economists all the time. Another way that someone who I think is terrific, who is Mohamed El-Arian, the CEO of PIMCO, the biggest bond fund, talks about how we have to get used to living with ambiguity and that is the new economic normal. I think that that's really true. And one of the things that I think was maybe a mistake in thinking about this financial crisis is feeling that maybe it was episodic, that it was a fire, the fire could be put out, and we would all go back to 2006. It is increasingly looking as if that's not the case. And the world economy has entered a new phase. Maybe it was already in that phase at the beginning of this century. We just didn't really notice it because some of the deeper structural problems were being masked by this debt. So I think, yeah, we all are living with uncertainty, and it's not restricted to the U.S. economy. There's this uncertainty in the whole world economy. And one of the biggest, most difficult things to figure out is how the different parts of the world economy interact. We've been talking about U.S. debt. One of the big issues right now, obviously, is European debt, where the debt crisis is more acute and where measures to deal with it are having a huge impact around the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich decided, after all his public protests, not to testify at his own trial.
I've learned a lot of lessons from this whole experience, and perhaps maybe the biggest lesson I've learned is that I talk too much.
Sarah Palin tweets and talks refudiation.
They have power in their words. They could refudiate what it is that this group is saying, and they could set the record straight.
They could, whatever that means. In a 40-pound dead jellyfish stung 150 people on a beach in New Hampshire. Here's an emergency official trying to explain.
Our understanding is the jellyfish tentacles will stay alive for 3 to 4 days after it had died, and pieces of it were floating around in the water.
Oh, boy, watch out. Chrystia Freeland is with us from Reuters, joins us from New York. Dana Milbeck of The Washington Post from Washington. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Let's go to Bruce in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to speak to the unemployment issue that you were discussing a moment ago.
Okay.
I've been on unemployment for some months now, and my unemployment's ran out. Unemployment benefits ran out several weeks back, so at the present time, I have nothing coming in. I don't know if this new appropriation is going to apply to me or not, because it doesn't apply to everybody. It's only people in certain category. But I want to say that the call from Savannah about the people on unemployment who want to work and take their payments under the table and continue to receive unemployment smacks of baiting the poor, just like the famous, you know, welfare Cadillac image that Reagan put out in the 80s. It is absurd to think that most people are honest and poor and trying to make it, and shame on you, Jack, for saying you suspect this is a widespread problem. You have absolutely no data to support that, and you're supporting the right-wing perception that poor, struggling people are somehow stealing from you know, the struggling middle class.
Well, let me ask you first, Bruce, if I may. I mean, if our caller from Savannah sees that happening, is that baiting the poor?
That's isolated.
It's anecdotal. I'll grant you that.
I would be very, very interested in any kind of data that anyone could gather that causes us to be able to acknowledge that that's a widespread incident.
Well, we don't have the data, but Jack, are you slurring the poor by seconding the notion it's widespread?
Well, I regret using that word. I should know better. I have no evidence. I guess what I was thinking of is people being, you know, people, human beings, the human condition being what it is, this will happen. And I should not have said widespread.
Bruce, are you out looking for a job, Bruce, or are you leaning back on, you know, depending on unemployment or what?
I've been pounding the pavement looking for a job for almost 6 months. I've been putting out job applications 3 or 4 a week. I have been doing a lot of networking, talking to everybody I know, saying, do you know of anything? I've been looking at the online job opportunities. There are some, but because of the way the market is, every opportunity they get 200, 250 applications, and they can afford to weed through them and pick the perfect candidate. And so, you know, if I don't happen to be just what they're looking for, I don't get the interview.
Well, I got to say, that doesn't sound like any joyride. Christia.
I was just going to speak to the point, if I could. Like Jack and Bruce, I don't have any actual data, but I can speak a little bit to the economic theory around this. It is actually true, and there have been a lot of studies about the impact of unemployment benefit that suggest that in normal economic times, unemployment benefit can be, if it goes on for a long time, can be a disincentive to seeking work for people. And there is a pretty robust body of literature around that. What's interesting, though, is that even right-wing economists are pretty much agreed that we are not living in normal times, and that that theory, that behavior, doesn't really apply to the current situation. Ken Rogoff, who's a Harvard professor, describes himself as right-wing, has been talking about this. And, you know, what he says is really what Bruce is experiencing, that in times like this, there just aren't enough jobs. And so this disincentive effect that people worry about in times of more robust economic growth, it doesn't really apply, because even if you throw yourself at the job market with, you know, as much avidity as anyone would like, there aren't going to be enough jobs to go around right now.
Here's a little clip from Debbie Stabenow, Democratic Senator of Michigan, about unemployment benefits and what they may mean for people who really need them right now.
This at least is the difference between families getting some help on Friday so they can feed the kids for the weekend, or whether they're going to have to wait till Monday.
If that's a reality in your house, the benefits are going to help. Let's go to Michael in Hull, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I understand you're moving on from unemployment to immigration.
Yeah? What have you got?
Well, they kind of go together, because for so many years, Americans said that they didn't want to take these jobs that the illegals had, and now they're saying they'll take any job. So if we continue to let the people come across the border, they are taking Americans' jobs. We can't afford to be paying them. And it would certainly fund some of these unemployment paychecks if we stopped giving the illegals these benefits. It's got to stop.
But what about in the Arizona law? What if it means people, you know, who just look a certain way get pulled over all over the place?
That's not going to happen. That's ridiculous. And if it was going on in Boston, there'd be a whole different attitude about it. It's not the point of the law, or if you've read it, it says you can't get pulled over for that.
Dana Milbank, you hear Bruce's, Michael's concern over unemployment and immigration. You know, it's in the court now in Arizona, and the judge there was kind of tough on the Justice Department representatives in some of the first conversations this week. Can you feel confidence, Dana, that this is not going to be used to, you know, outside the whatever nice definition there is about who gets pulled over where?
Well, that's since it hasn't begun to be enforced yet, that's going to be a matter to be tested. You can't be confident one way or the other what's going to occur there. What has clearly happened with this, the whole immigration debate, it's extraordinary how it's been, essentially this this fact-free zone. The border has been significantly safer, at least on the American side, than it has been for decades. The reports of violence and this flood of immigrants coming across just is not based in reality and in the facts. I do think that the call is correct. It's certainly related to the unemployment story, and in very difficult economic times, we turn and look to villains and immigrants, particularly the illegal ones, are a logical place for that to fall.
Dana, what are the facts you're talking about there? What are you referring to?
Well, I did a column on this a couple of weeks ago. You have Governor Brewer there in Arizona talking about people being found beheaded in the desert in Arizona. You have John McCain saying his own city of Phoenix there is the number two kidnapping capital in the world. There's all this talk of
is that wrong?
Border violence. Every single one of those things is wrong, or at least not grounded in any actual fact or statistic.
I wonder what may come out of this court. There was the Arizona Governor, Jan Brewer, this week talking with reporters. This is courtesy of ABC15.com, saying she's pretty confident that Judge Bolton in Arizona is maybe sympathetic to Arizona's case.
It's pretty apparent that Judge Bolton has a very good grasp, in my opinion, of the issues that we're undertaking in there today. And she certainly understands the dangers that Arizonans face in regards to harboring of illegals in the state of Arizona.
Jack Beatty, Judge Susan Bolton asking the Justice Department representative down there, why can't Arizona be as inhospitable as they wish to people who've entered or remained in the United States, I guess, illegally?
Yeah, and that's encouraging speculation that she may actually have a sort of split-the-difference decision, that some of this law can go forward and other parts of it can't. We'll have to see. But, you know, to return to Michael for a minute, I mean, he was making the case for comprehensive immigration reform. The argument, of course, is that one reason wages are bid down is that there are 12 million illegal people without papers who are bidding for jobs. They have no clout in the workplace. They will take anything, and that puts downward pressure on all jobs. If they are on a path to citizenship, if they can join unions, if they can confront employers as ordinary citizens can, that just the logic is would raise wages at the bottom. So if your concern is equity and raising wages for poor people, poor Americans, poor recent immigrants, then comprehensive immigration reform really is the only answer.
Well, of course, the draconian answer to that concern is to send everybody away. But is that Fred in Cookeville, Tennessee? Fred, you're on the air.
It's Jerry, not Fred.
Sorry, Jerry, you're on.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Yeah, the deal with the immigration, I know Dana Milbank said that there's no facts to support those stats that McCain was talking about and Governor Brewer. But there are probably, 12 to 15 people every day getting killed in car wrecks or murdered by illegal aliens? You know, so you do the math on that, and it's quite a bit.
Yeah, but what's your source for that, Jerry? I mean, Dana did a pretty good piece a couple of weeks ago, as he says, where he looked into a lot of these statistics flying around, and they turned out just not to be supported.
Well, I just wondered if Dana Milbank, if he was on the Journal list, if he was one of the people that that corresponded with the other journalists on the on one of the items that didn't make the news this week. That was about the journalists and academics and that were blogging each other about how to shape the news the way that suited them. But the illegal immigration issue, I mean, there are people back here. I've lost a cousin that was killed in a car wreck. I've lost friends out in California who were killed in car wrecks. I've had friends that were murdered by illegal aliens. So, I mean, these are people, I mean, real people that I knew, that I partied with when I was young, who were murdered and killed by illegal aliens.
Well, Jerry, let me take it back to Dana. I mean, Dana, are you hearing the statistics there or something else?
First, I'm not a member of this this list the caller was talking about, but look, there's thousands and tens of thousands of people killed in car wrecks, and I'm sure some of them are killed by illegal aliens because that is a substantial proportion of our population. There are in fact millions of them. I'm not sure where that takes us one way or the other in the debate. The fact is there is less violence on the border today than there was 10 years ago and 20 years ago. That's not to say immigration isn't a big problem and that we've got to do something very serious about it. It's just suggesting that the crisis of the moment is not driven by some change on the border. The crisis is driven largely by the economic situation, and that's what Americans are reacting to, rather than some change on the border. In fact, there's every reason for Mexicans not to be crossing the border, since they know there aren't any jobs here at this point.
Jack, and if I could just buttress
Christian,
that point,
yes, please, Christian.
I'm very sympathetic to Dana's point about fact-free debates, and maybe that's our leitmotif for today. Mm. We began with Ms. Sherrod.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the really interesting facts about undocumented workers is one of the responses that we saw in the market with the financial crisis and with the recession was fewer undocumented workers coming into the United States. And you actually had this sort of natural adjustment of the U.S. labor market because precisely as Dana says, there were fewer jobs here, so fewer people came here. And while I am certainly not making an argument in favor of undocumented workers, it was actually kind of interesting how you saw that adjustment, and that took a little bit of pressure off of what was happening in the U.S. economy. If all of those people had been – all of the people who were working here in 2006, 2007 had been fully documented, you would have seen an even sharper plunge in unemployment numbers.
Jack, I want to turn to another front, if I may, for just a moment. We've got a near-term crisis, maybe longer-term crisis, climate-wise. And Harry Reid saying this week he cannot pull together the votes to have a comprehensive climate bill. It appears to be off the table. What do you see there, Jack?
Yes, he said it was, quote, disappointing and dangerous that the Republicans wouldn't support it. He needed 7 Republicans. That's quite a lot to get to 60. And the reason he needed 7, he didn't mention this, was that so many Democrats from coal-producing states want no part of comprehensive climate change legislation before the election. And, you know, who's to blame here for the failure of this? Well, environmentalists in Politico today are blaming the president. And I see so is the New York Times. They're saying the president didn't push hard enough. He didn't. He hasn't given the big speech about, you know, what's at stake here. And the result is that the Republicans have you know, with their trope that this is going to, you know, it's cap and tax, that has got through to people. And so out it goes. Now, there is a deus ex machina, or at least a potential one for people who want action on this. The EPA does have the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions now, and we'll see what happens. But that's very controversial. Even Democratic senators are saying, please don't use that authority too rigorously. You know, desperately we need a populist solution here, and one is at hand. Susan Collins of Maine and Maria Cantwell of Washington, I think, have the rudiments of it: a tax cut for everybody in America. Put a a carbon tax on the big polluters and rebate every dime of that to the taxpayer so that if you just are slightly thrifty about your use of electricity, because you can actually make a fair amount of money off good environmental policy.
Speaking of populism, Dana, I got to ask you real quick. Sarah Palin's a populist. She said repudiate. Does it matter?
I think it's a brilliant word to refute and repudiate all at once. I think she's been misunderestimated.
It's a matter of efficiency there, maybe. And with that, off we go. Chrystia Freeland, it is always great to have you. Thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for joining us from New York, Chrystia.
It was fun. Thank you.
Chrystia Freeland, Global Editor-at-Large for Thomson Reuters and Dana Milbank at the Washington Post. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dana.
My pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
And listeners, same to you. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Have a great weekend.